everybody out there, and welcome to Maybe Next Year, episode 11. I'm your host, Corey Foss, and tonight, co-hosting with me, I have Dave Scogan. Dave, thanks for helping out tonight.
Absolutely, man.
And then our first section here, we're going to talk a little about the Twins. We have our guest, Mike Hawes. Mike as well, thanks for coming on tonight.
My pleasure.
Let's see, we just a little business beforehand. If you want to check us out, some of our easiest access, go to Apple Podcast. We go up on Anchor right away. And also then if Spotify is easier for you, you can check us out there. Just search Maybe Next Year and we're the first thing to pop up. You can catch up with all of our first 10 episodes there. And you can also check out our new website, nextyearpodcast.com. And not only are there cool things on there like meeting the host and meeting all the guests and a little bit about us, but also you can link to all of our episodes right there and listen to them from there. And you can also send in questions if you have any questions or anything that you're interested in or would like us to talk about on the next show. Just go to the contact button and submit a question for us. And we'd love to hear from those of you guys out there listening and maybe talk about something that interests you the next time around. Our website, which is pretty cool if you get a chance and check it out, is thanks in part to Minnesota Nice Marketing. So just a little bit about Minnesota Nice Marketing, one of our sponsors. In today's website world, website credibility judgments are 75% based on overall aesthetics, which means the design and functionality of your website are more important than ever. First impressions are 94% design related. This is where Minnesota Nice Marketing comes into the picture. Minnesota Nice Marketing exists to help small businesses create a collaborative web and mobile page that is easy to understand, affordable, and helps you be found out and seen online. Visit MinnesotaNiceMarketing.com to get your free quote for your web page or web redesign. And remember, 85% of adults think that the company's mobile website should be just as good or better than their desktop site. So yes, go ahead and check that out. And if you're, you can also link to them through our site. If you scroll down to the bottom of our web page, their link is there as well. So whatever's easiest for you. All right, tonight's show, we're going to talk about a couple different things. Things have been absolutely bonkers in the last 48 hours in the sports world in Minnesota with the Twins and the Timberwolves making some deals. And we'll talk about those tonight. First up, we're going to talk about the Twins, though. And as there's been, there was a trade in theory that took place yesterday. And there's been some questions today as to maybe the health of one of the people involved. But we're just going to go ahead and assume that the trade that was proposed will go through here. And with it, it was part of the big three-team deal with the Boston Red Sox and the LA Dodgers. We knew that they had been talking about Mookie Betts for a little while. And there was a third mystery team kind of in there at the last moment. And it turns out it was the Twins. And so on top of what happened with Betts and Price going to Boston, also the Twins will, in a roundabout way, end up shipping their number one pitching prospect, Broussard Gratterall, and to Boston. And in kind of a roundabout way, we'll get back from the Dodgers, Kenta Maeda, a 31-year-old starting pitcher we'll talk maybe a little bit about the numbers and stuff like that, but it's definitely an interesting find if that is what exactly goes through. You know, initially when the reports and things came out, everything was happening kind of in a hurry and online, and things were playing out on Twitter and all kinds of stuff like that. And there were some unhappy Twins fans. Gratterall, like I said, was the number one pitching prospect, was a kind of a fan darling. He threw 101 miles an hour in a game. And I think that people saw a lot of upside in him, and he's young, he's 21. And so there were questions about, you know, why ship him and get somebody like Maeda back, who had a so-so year last year with the Dodgers. He was 10-8 with a 4.04 ERA. He pitched in 37 games and started 26 of them. The Dodgers kind of have run him back and forth between the bullpen and as a starter. But there are some real positives to him. He's been in LA for 4 years. He came over from Japan. In that 4 years, he's 47-35 with a 3.87 ERA. And his contract is something that is really desirable. He has four more years left of team control at $3.25 million a year, which is something, like I said, is a real positive. If you're looking at it from that standpoint, he has 24 postseason appearances. So he has some positives there, especially if the Twins are looking beyond just winning the division and wanting somebody that has some experience there. He's a strikeout pitcher, and even though his average fastball is about 92 miles an hour, he's a strikeout pitcher. He averages 10 Ks per nine last year, which is even higher than Gratterall had. But, you know, we can talk about the numbers and stats all you want. I guess I'll kind of open it up to you guys, you know, like as things were happening, you know, communicating back and forth and really trying to sort things out. But assuming that Maeda does come to Minnesota, what were some of your, you know, real initial reactions and things like that, Mike?
Yeah, so it's a little bit awkward to even be talking about this right now because we don't have a resolution on the injury concerns that Boston raised. We don't know what that's going to look like, what it's finally going to go through. So by the time people are listening to this, maybe Brusdar remains a Twin, or, you know, maybe Maeda doesn't come here. Maybe we have to trade somebody else. But anyway, my initial reaction, I mean, that was really crazy. The whole Betts thing coming down the pike was insane. And like you said, it was first reported that there was a mystery team involved, a third team involved with the talks between Boston and LA. And I was kind of crossing my fingers that it was something that Minnesota could be that third mystery team, and that maybe Price would be coming to Minnesota, because I think we talked about on this podcast maybe a month or two ago about how Price is essentially a negative trade value. So you just have to pick up a portion of his contract to get him, really. And that's indeed sort of what happened with LA. I think they're sending back like $45 million to Boston. But anyway, I was thinking along those lines, and people were throwing out other prospects' names of from LA, like Dustin May. And then it came out that it was Kenta Maeda, and then it came out that it was Brusdar for him. And the people that I was texting with are just like, is this a joke? This can't be it. Like, they have to get something back more than Maeda for Brusdar, because Brusdar is considered, you know, a pretty highly touted prospect. And Maeda, as you talked about, has been shuffled in between the bullpen and the starting rotation, and doesn't seem any much better than a three starter. And, you know, personally, I've owned Maeda in fantasy baseball, and he's maddening to own just for those same reasons, because the Dodgers are kind of, more than any other baseball club, they are really weird with their pitchers. They'll phantom IL them. They'll send them down to the minors for a couple weeks. They'll send them to the bullpen. They'll skip starts, all as a matter to keep their innings down. And I should also say that the contract that you were talking about with the $3 million, that's actually just Maeda's base salary. So $3 million is the minimum that he could make. And then he's got a number of escalators that can get him way over that based on innings pitched and starts made. So...
I had read that that was part of why LA had treated or had done the way that he did with his innings, is try to keep him under those barriers.
I mean, nobody can prove it or whatever, because they have plausible deniability that they can just that they're trying to save his arm for the postseason, or that he's had injury concerns in the past. He's older, he can't take on that workload. But yes, they definitely have a financial incentive to keep his innings and his starts down. Can I just read this really quick? This is verbatim from the Star Tribune today, talking about his unique kind of contract with all those incentives. So it says the 31-year-old Maeda earns an extra $1 million when he makes his 15th start of the season, and he collects another $1 million at 20 starts. His 25th, 30th, and 32nd starts add another $1.5 million bonus to his pay. And starting at his 90th inning, he receives an extra $250,000 for every 10 innings he pitches, a fee that rises to $750,000 for his 200th inning. By that math, Maeda collected $8.75 million in incentives in 2016, when he remained a starter all season and made 32 starts, giving him a total salary of $11.9 million. His paycheck dipped to $7.25 million the following season, and just $6 million in 2018. He was paid $8.4 million last year. So the $3 million is definitely a base salary, and you can see how the Dodgers have kind of been able to manipulate that a little bit. So, but
With that said, the innings manipulation is also clouding, I think, our judgment of him as a pitcher, because there's a lot of people kind of in the industry that look at that K9 that you talked about, the 10 strikeouts per nine innings number, and like his elite stuff, even despite his fastball, as being somebody who, if he's kind of unleashed and he's relieved of his Dodgeritis, as they call it, that he could be like much more of an elite type pitcher, like closer to a number two than a number three pitcher. So I think people were excited to see him on another team and just see how his usage would change.
Yes. So Dave, after, you know, kind of having a little bit of time to actually absorb this deal, as opposed to initial reactions, what are some things that kind of came across to you as you were debating whether this was a decent deal for the Twins or not?
You know, I think Mike hit the nail on the head. You know, I kind of came full circle on this thing. You know, kind of when it first broke, I was like, yeah, the same thing. You got to be kidding me. That's all we got for a guy who throws 102, who's our top prospect, you know, pitching prospect in the organization. I was actually a little bit intrigued when I looked at the stats a little bit about how good Aida was in relief, only to quickly read an article about how, you know, upset he was with LA, that they put him in relief roles. You know, I read the article in the Star Tribune here this afternoon too, about the contract thing, and it's clear manipulation by LA to kind of keep his contract down. You know, looking at the stats, he's got good stuff. You know, basically, he's a three pitch, really two pitch pitcher, fastball, slider. But he's very tough on righties. He's gonna fill a big void until, you know, Pineda can come back and if Hill can come back. He definitely gives a solid 1-2-3 pitcher. It'll still be interesting to see come the end of the season, or if they do get into the playoffs, you know, how they handle the staff. You know, he's definitely got incentive to pitch often and pitch well, because I've never seen a contract like that. You know, the fact that he made an additional $8.75 million. By hitting incentives in 2016, you know, he's not going to miss starts. If he's healthy, he's going to pitch, and he's going to try and pitch as well as he can to keep his spot in rotation. You know, looking at Gratterall, it's a big loss. Anytime you got a guy who throws that hard, who's that young, you obviously look at potential. I don't see Gratterall ever being, you know, a starting pitcher. I have. You don't see guys who throw that hard, that young, who have already had arm problems, pan out as starters in my eyes. He's going to be a bullpen role. He probably could be a closer down in time. You know, I actually watched a little video of him last night in his mechanics. And for a guy who throws that hard, he throws very, very upright. You watch the way he brings his shoulder across. And to me, it looks like
more a
ticking time bomb. You know, there's so much, as you know, Corey, there's so much stress that goes on with an elbow and a shoulder when you throw. A throwing motion is not a natural motion for your body. And the way that shoulder comes across and has to stop, he has no follow through forward. You watch like Aroldis Chapman and Max Scherzer, guys who have very violent deliveries. They're getting themselves so far out in front and coming down where that arm has time to, you know, at least a little bit slow down before it slams into the side of the body. Where you watch Gratterall throw, and it's literally, he's basically standing straight up and just winging it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's where Boston's, you know, caution is coming into, if they're looking at this and looking at him a little bit closer, thinking, oh, wait a minute here. This guy's not going to pan out the way we originally thought. Hindsight's going to be 20/20 on this deal. Hopefully the Twins have got a guy, you know, like you'd mentioned, Corey, this is kind of a, they're pushing the chips a little bit further into the table. They're willing to give up a prospect to solidify things, especially early in the season of that rotation. And maybe this is the first of moves to come, you know, if they start really pushing and the record is coming the way we think it is win-loss-wise, you know, maybe we start seeing another prospect go. Personally, if they were going to make this Gratterall move at some point, I wish, you know, maybe they would have done it earlier for a little bit bigger top of the end rotation guy. But, you know, maybe he's going to prove us all wrong. And like Mike said, maybe he will be that kind of number 1-2 guy we've been looking for.
I think, you know, when you're talking about the strain and stuff like that on the arm, I think when we're looking at what is possibly holding up Boston, because they took a look at some of his medical records, and I think that they had really thought that he was going to be a starter. That was kind of what they were pegging him for. And maybe after seeing some of the med records, thinking, well, maybe that's not exactly the case. I think I don't know how that could have been a surprise to them. I mean, anybody that that throws it that hard, you know, does face some real lingering issues, or especially if you're having problems at a young age. You know, a little bit Maeda. The more that I looked up to Maeda, the more that I looked into him, I think probably the more relaxed I got about the actual deal. Even though his fastball isn't incredible, you know, it's 92 miles an hour on average. He's in the 96th percentile in exit velocity and 95th percentile in hard hit percentage. So, you know, he's creating soft contact in what he's doing. He's pretty elite in limiting hard contact. He has a large whiff rate, a very big whiff rate on his slider and changeup. And his fastball basically serves more or less as a setup then for those pitches, which I think if you're looking at probably an improved infield now with Donaldson there, maybe that went into a thinking a little bit, is that we have some soft contact guy. Now that we have a little bit better defense, stronger infield defense, he's a good fit for that. I guess, you know, the other question I'll ask you guys, you know, we've looked at Gratterall, we can look at his numbers, but, you know, having Tommy John in 16, having elbow surgery in 17, having 2 months out last year, you know, I don't know how that could have been a surprise to Boston, but I think, you know, you see somebody throw that hard and fans tend to fall in love with that because, you know, there's few things more exciting to watch than somebody throw 100 miles an hour. But I guess that what I really was wondering, and you just briefly mentioned a little bit, Dave, is that does this move, and I think some people think this, that it signifies, you know, this isn't a typical Twins move. A different front office doesn't make that move. You don't unload. Twins have never unloaded top prospects. You know, so that definitely shows you that there's some different thinking in the front office at this point. But does this mean that the Twins, that the front office, that everybody else, are they all in 2020 based off of this move, Mike?
I mean, yeah, you're right. That is the way to look at it. So regardless kind of how you feel about Gratterall, like if you think he's going to be a frontline starter someday in 3 years, or if you think he's going to be just a bullpen arm, it doesn't change the fact that this is definitely a push your chips in type of a deal, that they feel like they have a window right now and that they just need something to keep them in the race and solidify their rotation and get some depth to the rotation that will carry them into October. So this is the kind of move that people have been clamoring for a long time, is saying, okay, leverage some of your future talent for more talent present value. And that's exactly what they're trying to do here. And it is totally weird to see it as a Twins fan, because it's weird. We're used to hugging our prospects very hard and dreaming on them and assuming that they're going to be here for a long time, because the Twins just don't usually trade them away. So I think that was definitely jarring. But then it's also like, at the same time, it's like, this is going to be an exciting season. If this all goes through, it's going to be, the Twins are going to be the favorite for sure to repeat the Central, and it's going to be just a really exciting season. And even though they're still not going to be as good as the Dodgers or the Yankees or the Astros, probably they're going to be right there, and they're going to have a shot in October. And then you're just kind of enjoying the whole season waiting for that next shot in October. So, I mean, it's like stealing from a position of strength for sure. And you're pushing the chips in. We keep using that metaphor, but that's exactly what they're doing. I think that's about as much as they can do. I don't think they're going to deal like away the whole farm, because I think they're still confident that, you know, they're not going to leverage their entire future to just compete this year. But they're definitely willing to like make some strategic moves to make it more likely that they get back to the playoffs this year.
Yeah, I think we tend to forget. I mean, maybe we don't tend to forget, but the Twins have not won a playoff game since 2004, and they have not won a series since 2002. And I think, you know, maybe that's on the minds. And I think we all saw what happened in October with, you know, you win 101 games, but then you get swept out because you don't have the pitching to compete. You know, you can hit 307 home runs, but that's not always going to get you through in October. You got to have some arms there. And, you know, maybe that's kind of the thinking behind this a little bit. He does have a lot of postseason experience. He's not a Gerrit Cole, you know, anything like that. But he is somebody that I think can be effective. in tough situations like that. So Dave, I guess, you know, looking at where they're at now with this rotation with Berríos and Odorizzi and Homer Bailey, if you throw Maeda in there, is there an odd man out between Pineda and Hill, or, you know, what happens? What do you see happening with that rotation? And I think it probably, for the most part, it wipes out chances of Dobnak and Thorpe and Smeltzer really playing a big role, at least especially as summer drags on or whatever. But how do you see everything playing out, at least with the rotation?
You know, I think that's going to be really interesting, and especially through spring training, will be very, very interesting to see how it all shakes out. I mean, you look at a rotation, if you go, you know, Odorizzi, Berríos, Maeda, Pineda, and Bailey, you got five right-hand pitchers. You don't have lefty. You know, you look at the Twins' bullpen set up right now, really your only lefty is your closer.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of your bullpen is all righties too. So, you know, I think there's going to be, and I mentioned a while back, you know, maybe will a way to keep Rich Hill as effective as possible is to use him in a possible bullpen situation, especially in the playoffs. I think you maybe see Smeltzer end up as kind of your long relief guy in the pen. Once they get Rich Hill healthy, I think you almost have to, by default, have him in a rotation just as a left-handed guy in your rotation. Then it comes down to Pineda and Bailey. You know, Bailey's going to have, 2 months, 3 months head start, 2 months head start on Pineda. I've said it before, I'll say it again. You know, Pineda, if he doesn't come in the best shape of his life, there's something wrong with the guy. You know, he's had plenty of time. He's been healthy. You know, he obviously was the drug he got in trouble for was either for busting weight or covering up steroids. Either way, he's had time now to get himself physically ready and right. So he should come in the best shape of his life to perform. I really think, though, that Hill's going to end up as your 3-4. Maeda's going to end up as your 3-4 somewhere in there. When it comes down to playoffs, it's probably going to depend on who they are playing, righty, lefty, you know, the majority of the lineup there as to who would might get that third game start. But I'm a Smeltzer guy. I like how Smeltzer mixes it up. He's kind of a bulldog. He keeps guys off balance. I mean, to me, he would make sense as a lefty pin arm. You know, it'll be interesting to see how that bullpen shakes out, though. And maybe there's guys that are on the 40-man roster that'll be at spring training that we're not talking about that'll show some promise.
Well,
somebody's got to be a left-handed arm in the pen.
Well, I was going to ask you that with this new three-batter rule, we had to face three batters. Don't you think that would kind of do away a little bit with that lefty specialist?
It's the lefty specialist for sure, and that's where, to me, like a guy like Rich Hill, who is used to facing, you know, multiple batters at a time, could be beneficial in the bullpen situation where, you know, he's not just a lefty thumber who's used to throwing against lefty hitters. He knows how to work against righty hitters. He knows how to work against lefty hitters. He's got that, you know, back-breaking curveball that's effective against anybody. It's just something to maybe put out there. Is it going to happen? Maybe not, but you do have to have at least a lefty in your pen. The chance that they're going to get used, though, to me is much more diminished, like you said, because of this three batter rule. It's taken a lot of the, I don't want to say the strategy, but the kind of the familiarity away from a lot of the coaches, what they've been used to. So it's going to change things, and it's going to be really interesting how, not just how the Twins shake it out, but across baseball and how it affects, you know, pitching decisions, how it affects hitters' decisions, and if it actually saves time in the game. In certain situations, I don't see it happening.
You know, Mike, I know that you follow everything and that goes on in the Twitter world and things like that as this is playing out, but there was a lot of angry fans that night. I don't know if there's as many now after calming down a little bit, but do you think Twins fans, those that were, have some kind of, are they warranted for being angry about this? And do you think that this is, I mean, if you were making this move, is this a move that you're going to pull the trigger on?
Well, I think it's, like I said, it's a little bit confusing in two ways. It's confusing because Bruzar Gratterall, I mean, I saw that Aaron Kleeman wrote today that Bruzar Gratterall has the best stuff of any Twins pitching prospect ever. And that's not an exaggeration. I mean, he's just got insane stuff. So when you
we've got a prospect like that, it's easy to kind of fall in love and just expect the 90th percentile kind of outcome, even if it's not reality, even if there's things that we don't know about his arm and his health and his durability and his injury history. It's kind of, it's a lot easier as a fan just to dream on the upside and the ceiling. So I think from that emotional standpoint, yeah, it's warranted for sure. And the other thing though, which I was talking about earlier, is when you're trading a one for one player, it's hard to understand kind of what it's going to look like in 5 years. So the Twins could look stupid, you know, possibly in 5 years. If Gratterall ends up being some sort of a Syndergaard type ace or even a relief ace like Josh Hader. But if the trade will have still worked well if the Twins, like, you know, win the World Series, knock on wood, because flags fly forever, you know. So if you're trying to win right now, which a lot of fans I don't think understand, especially like in the heat of the moment, like when the news is coming down, that the different kind of winning curves and windows that the teams are on, so that there's a lot of variables to take into account. So I don't blame people for being upset at all right away. But I think since that news came out about the it being held up with the medicals and the Red Sox realizing that he's not going to be a starter for them either, then a lot of Twins fans are like, yeah, we need to push this through before somebody gets wise. You know, we're not trying to pull a Dyson on anybody, but like, come on. Like the Red Sox have to do their homework, and if they agree to the deal, it would be nice to get it through. But I think that's just what a lot of Twins fans are feeling now.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly things can change. All of a sudden, when you see all of a sudden the other team is maybe throwing up some flags, and there are things that maybe you didn't consider when initially, but.
Right, and you dig into the numbers like you did. I mean, you looked up Maeda's numbers and saw that there's some promise there. And then I looked into Cruzdar's projection, and he's only projected between like 36 and 63 innings. So that's 63 innings at less than a K per nine, you know, out of the bullpen. I mean, you know, we can talk about what that does to the bullpen, because 63 innings is still valuable, but like that's not as big of an impact on 2020. And if you're playing for 2020, then, you know, the Kenta is the upgrade.
Okay. We got about 2 minutes left here. Any final thoughts, Mike, as you're, you know, taking a look and hoping that, are you hoping that this goes through, I guess?
Yeah, I think I'm hoping this goes through because with the injury history now, that kind of opened a lot of fans' eyes, including myself. I love Brewster. I mean, I follow him on Instagram. He's a good follow. He's got a real baby face. He's a cute little kid, basically. He's still really young. And so it's always fun to watch players throw the baseball as far as they can. But I would also be excited for Maeda to be here and to see what he would do in a different uniform outside the Dodgers. And, you know, be excited for the Twins to kind of push forward, because without Maeda, it is still definitely iffy, especially before Hill and Pineda get back. So I hope it goes through. Hopefully it's just a matter of like sending a few more million dollars from the Dodgers or the Twins. But if they have to pivot to a hitting prospect, you know, I guess that would be okay too, since the Twins have a lot of hitters in their system that could be dealt. But I guess we'll see what happens.
All right, so you got about 30 seconds left, Mike. I'm going to ask you one last question. You can answer it quick for me. If we go in with this lineup right now and with this staff right here, can the Twins win in October?
Yes, they can. October is mostly about luck. That's what I'm sticking with. So, yes, they can. I think you have to do two of three things, right? Bullpen, starting pitching, and relief. One of those things can be a deficit, and you can still win. So I think the Twins could still win. Yes.
All right. I like the positivity. That's good. Thanks a lot for joining us, Mike. Me and Dave will be back here with talking a little bit about the Timberwolves and all the craziness that's gone on there as well. So come on back. Welcome back to episode 11 of Maybe Next Year. Next, we're going to try and somehow sort out everything that's gone on in the last 24 hours with the Timberwolves. They haven't been much of a talking point outside of earlier this year, but they are definitely a talking point right now. I guess we'll start with what happened yesterday. Bigger developments even today, but yesterday they started their massive overhaul as part of a four. It was the biggest, I think, trade in 20 years or something like that, with four teams involved. They end up sending Noah Vonleh, Bates Diop, and Shabazz Napier to Denver, and Jordan Bell to Houston. They got a couple names back, Malik Beasley, who I think is probably the one name outside of now Russell that they were actually thinking about probably holding on to. He was averaging about 8 points a game, but he's a pretty good spot up outside shooter, 40% 3-point spot ups, which is a huge, something that Timberwolves have always lacked forever. They've never had, it seems like. And then Hernan Gomez, is that, he played 34 games and he's averaging 3 points. And they'd actually mentioned him being a name they wanted to resign. I thought that was interesting because it didn't look like the Vanderbilt kid. He is just played in the G League this year. He hasn't played at all. One name that, if you were a fan 10 years ago, well, not 10 years ago, but Evan Turner, who was a number two pick in 2010. He was a big name then. He has a big contract too. He's still owed $18 million, but he's only played 19 games. He's only averaging 3 points. He's 31 years old. So he's not really part of the long-term plans either, I wouldn't think. And they got a first-round pick from Atlanta. But it's protected. It's lottery protected. But the Nets are on. Looks like they're on their way to the playoffs. So that would mean then that the Timberwolves would get it this next year. We were just talking about Karl Anthony Towns being upset. He was upset about Covington leaving. He said that Covington was his best friend. And there's nothing worse than a really unhappy NBA drama queen and how that can affect a team. But now today, it looks like the Wolves are back in his good graces as they pulled off a huge trade, probably the biggest I can remember, for D'Angelo Russell, who was the guy that they wanted all along. Ever since Rosas took over as president, that's who he's targeted. And I always kind of wondered exactly why that is. Russell's 23 years old. He was the number two pick as well in 2015. He was a pick right after Cat. Cat went one that year, and then he went two. But in his 5 years, he's played for four teams. He was drafted by L.A., and then there was all that kind of drama that went on with him and who was the guy he took a video of, one of the other players there.
Young.
Yeah, and then he went to Brooklyn and it was actually an all-star there and had a great year and then signed with Golden State this offseason in a sign-in trade, and a lot of the Wolves front office was upset about that. They had really gone hard after him. And so they got him now, and I think probably the biggest talking point, even bigger than getting their target, is they shipped out Andrew Wiggins for him. And I think every Wolves fan is exhausted as it is talking about Andrew Wiggins for the last 4 years, about what you want him to do and what he hasn't done. And just, it's been very frustrating to watch him, coming out as the number one pick, thinking that, waiting for him to finally turn the corner or whatever. And it looked like he might have a little bit earlier this season, but it had really gone backwards since November. But he's gone and he's in Golden State now, and they traded him and a first and second round pick in 21. So it's a good thing they have that pick coming from Atlanta, because they sold two of them off with Wiggins. And then on top of that, if that wasn't enough, Gorgui Dieng, the longest tenured Wolf, was sent to Memphis for James Johnson. I don't know if you know anything about James Johnson, because I don't. It ends up saving $1 million. Dieng and Wiggins both had really undesirable contracts. Wiggins was on a max contract. Dieng was on, I think it was like $18 million a year, which was, for somebody that doesn't play as much as he does, that was kind of insane. But I think when it's all said and done, the wildest thing to look at, Dave, is that now Towns is the longest tenured Wolf, and the only other one that has been there, Rosas took over 2 years ago in May, and the only other one remaining from his time is Josh Okogie. There are two players remaining from when he started. That is a quick turnover. you know, for all this to happen in 24 hours, it kind of makes your head spin. So I guess if you're going to try and make sense of any of it, you know, what can you make sense of, Dave?
Oh, what's amazing is we were on this show last week talking about how Timberwolves roster did not fit at all what they want to do fundamentally on offense. And like you just said, within 24 hours, now you look at their roster and it's like, wow, that thing really changed quickly. Now you have a point guard who can shoot the ball from basically inside the gymnasium. You picked up a shooting guard in Malik Beasley, who is, like you said, a spot up 3-point shooter. You now have some flexibility of power forward. You know, you mentioned James Johnson James Johnson, Miami Heat guy. He's always kind of been a little bit of a 3-and-D guy. He's got some edge to him. But what I see with him is he's got a weird player option next year. So if I'm the Timberwolves, I actually don't play him at all and tell him to basically get out of here. And you're going to get $15.5 million off the books next year. They also have Evan Turner, who for the time being, I think is going to be really beneficial as basically a point forward. He's always been kind of that point forward guy. That's exactly what Jared Culver needs to learn too. He needs to learn how to handle the ball, you know, learn how to be a pro. I think he's going to be a positive influence on him. He's $18.5 million coming off the books next year too.
With the Russell deal, they're actually in the luxury tax now with the Russell deal.
Yep. Alan Crabby, another spot up 3-point shooter who might fit this offense a little bit. Another guy who's an unrestricted free agent next year. Another $18.5 million coming off the books. You get two first round picks. You're probably spending $12 million. You know, combination of unit two. You got $40 million open now. Come free agency. Now, like you just mentioned, with the luxury tax, I don't know how far down they got to get. But in talking about Towns and in talking about D'Angelo Russell, there was a column out here, I don't know, a while back, last offseason, about, you know, Devin Booker being very good friends with D'Angelo Russell and Karl Anthony Towns. Well, you just opened up a whole pile of money come free agency. Now, he signed to, I think he's due $30 million next year, in the midst of a 5-year deal, but you just opened up a bunch of money. You got two first round picks sitting there who did not want to use them. You've got some ammunition now to go and get a free agent next year. You've turned this thing around so quickly that you've got options now to build for next year and starting next year. You know, the way they scheduled this deal with Golden State, they were able to keep their two first round picks next year, give up the one in 21. Hopefully, if they do all their planning right, this thing turns around. And they're at least in the playoffs, so that thing's not a lottery pick. It's top three protected. God, I hope they're not a top three pick.
I hope not.
Or we're really, really going to be in the hurt pick. But yeah, I can't believe how quick they turned their roster around into something that fits the scheme that they're trying to run. Now, defensively, I think they're still a total mess.
Yeah, they will.
But man, they're probably going to score some points. And the biggest thing to me with all this is like you mentioned, they traded Covington, Towns threw a fit, said he's sick of losing. Well, you know what, buddy? They've lost 13 games in a row, and I think of games that he's played, they've lost 18 in a row.
Yep.
The Atlanta game the other night, I read in one of the reviews of the game that on the Atlanta broadcast, they commented about the lack of effort numerous times.
He looked really, really disinterested.
He's disinterested. He's always been disinterested. He doesn't put out effort, especially on the defensive end. Well, now they bent over backwards. They moved mountains to get your guy. Now it's time to get it going. You know, show everybody the franchise player you are. You got your best friend. You got your homie. Now it's time to start balling and showing everybody what you can do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with Russell and Towns now, does this kind of possibly become a desirable place maybe for one of those, maybe not the biggest names, but somebody near that upper tier?
I think it does. You know, you've got two elite. You know, I've been critical of D'Angelo Russell in the past. In fact, up until last year, I really didn't like him at all. He's a ball heavy guard. He did not fit in my eyes next to Towns and Wiggins. So when they were going after him in the offseason, to me, it's like, how is this going to work? They got Wiggins out, and now you got two elite offensive players. They're going to be recruiting this offseason. They're going to be recruiting over All-Star Weekend, and both of them are sitting at home, you know, not doing anything. They're going to be calling up their buddies. They're going to try and find a third wheel. Now, the deal with Booker, they have to go out and try and trade for him, which is going to cost some assets. But I think there's a third wheel that's going to be getting into the cog next year at some point.
And that's kind of what it takes in today's NBA, doesn't it? It takes more. It takes about three. And then if you can kind of build, mix and match, misfit toys around those three, that's sometimes what it's. I'm looking at name. I mean, it's stunning how much things have changed. You know, Rosas took over May 1st of last year. This is what he had for a roster, and these are the names of all the people that are now gone within, you know, that amount of time. You know, we lost Bates Diop, Jared Bayless, Robert Covington, Luol Deng, Gorgui Dieng, Taj Gibson, Tyus Jones, Derrick Rose, Jeff Teague, Anthony Tolliver, and now Andrew Wiggins. I mean, it's this complete overhaul, and I don't think anybody is complaining about that. I really don't. After watching this product on the court the last, you know, couple months, it's been very difficult to watch. But how excited were you when you saw that Wiggins was on the way out?
You know, it's kind of funny because you hate to be excited about a guy's failure, but man, has he been frustrated. You know, back when he was in high school, they talked about him basically as the next LeBron James. That's how good he was in high school.
Yeah.
I saw a deal the other day talking about, you know, the greatest high school players ever. His name was listed. And you saw glimpses of it. And to me, that's what was the most frustrating, is you saw how good he could be. And then the next possession down the court, you're wondering, how is this guy in the NBA? I mean, that's how bad it would get from time to time. You know, for him, he's going into a really good situation. He's not going to have to be the guy or even the next guy. His best asset is cutting and slashing, because he's a very slippery guy. He's got crazy athleticism. Now he doesn't have to try and create his own shot at all. You got Steph Curry, and you got Klay Thompson, who's going to shoot from the outside, and you got Draymond Green, who's probably going to beat him into the ground every day in practice.
Yep.
But he's going into a good situation where he doesn't – maybe he's a guy who puts too much pressure on himself, and it just doesn't work. I don't know. He doesn't even have to worry about that. He's basically a better Harrison Barnes for that Golden State Warriors team via NBA Finals here the past few years. So he's been in a good situation that he's going to produce. He's not going to have the expectations to produce like he did in Minnesota, but it's a hell of a lot of money that they're spending on a guy to cut and slash and score 15 a game.
Yeah, I was thinking like, is he going to really hang on in Golden State, or are they looking, you know, to do something else with him, whether it be at the end of the year or now? I mean, now the Wolves now have 32 games left this season, and I for one cannot wait to tune in the next couple games just to see what kind of product they can put out there. It's going to be interesting, to say the least. You know, I'm looking at Malik Beasley. I'm really interested to see how he plays. You know, Jarrett Culver, who, you know, the rookie who a lot of expectations from him, he has been horrendous shooting the basketball, absolutely horrendous, and which kind of fits the mold for the Wolves year. But whether, you know, he'll be able to pick that up a little bit over these last couple months. You know, Jacob Evans was one of the names as well. I don't know, Amari Spellman, those two came from Golden State, pretty much as throw-ins. The other name besides Beasley, I guess, that they were talking about is someone they were going to look seriously at, was Hernan Gomez. I don't know if you know anything about him.
A little bit, you know, coming from the Nuggets. The Nuggets are really, really banged up last year. I feel like the Nuggets are always banged up, but Will Barton was out for an extended period of time. I can't remember who the other, you know, Gary Harris seems to be always hurt. But he had a run last year in the middle of the season where he started, you know, for almost a good month, I think. And in that offense, he didn't put up a lot, but I think he put up decent. He played well on the court. He's not going to be a guy that blows. You look at his stats, and his stats are basically next to nothing.
Yeah.
From his stats, but he can shoot a little bit. He can play some small forward. He can play some power forward, which he's kind of your typical stretch four. You know, it's kind of ironic. He was the 15th pick in 2016. Malik Beasley was the 19th pick in 2016. So he was at that point, he was pretty highly regarded out of, I believe it was Spain. But I don't know. He's worth a kick, you know, kick the tires. You're not into him. He's in for $3.5 million this year. He's got a qualifying offer next year for 4.6. So, you know, you get a guy like Jake Lehman back if he can ever get over his turf toe.
Yeah.
You know, he's been a missing piece. He was actually playing fairly well before he got hurt. I don't know. There's some pieces here that you can work with. At least they're going to get a look at these guys now for the next, you know, few months to see if this is, you know, who do we want to bring back? Who are we going to prioritize? You know, they shipped out a pile of power forwards and we brought back a pile of power forwards. So, I don't, you know, Amari Spellman, he's actually, you know, 6'8", Villanova, 3 a game. Even this year in minimal minutes for Golden State. So you talk about that stretch four position again, the guy can shoot a little bit. I'm kind of a Naz Reid guy. I'd like to see him get some more playing time, but then again, I guess I'm still kind of more of that old school, your fours and your fives, they got to rebound and box out and block some shots. He's just a big body dude underneath there.
It'll be really interesting.
Like him get some more run.
It'll be really interesting to see what this, whether they're going to give up 145 points a game or what's going to happen. I can't grasp what it's going to be like for Saunders to try and get something functioning in the next week or so with all these different pieces, you know. And there's going to be a lot of confusion about this. So, you know, there's going to be three names that you recognize out there, you know, Okogie and Russell and Wiggins. And the rest of it is going to be played by ear, and it could be quite ugly, but it could also be very interesting to watch. So one of the things about being out of the race is that you don't have to, I mean, it is, as much as it's not fun that you're not watching a team that you're rooting for to get to the playoffs. I think probably, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago on this, maybe it was last week, Dave, where we said, you got to blow it up. I mean, we literally said that, like it was as bad as I think. And there have been some bad Wolves teams over the last decade or so. And this was probably the hardest one to watch because you did not see any way out of it without blowing it up. I mean, there just were no pieces that really seemed to fit together. And and that was a big thing with Rosas is he wants to make this big push towards quote-unquote modern basketball, you know, the running and shooting and a little bit smaller lineup and that kind of thing, and just didn't have the guys for it with that lineup. And maybe, you know, this is on him. You know, it's on him. And it's either going to work or it's going to fail spectacularly. But either way, it's going to be on him because he got what he wanted. You know, this is what he wanted starting a year and a half ago. And here it is. And the crazy part is it all happened in about 24 hours. So, it'll be something to watch unfold here. And I guess we'll probably be having more conversations about the Wolves over the next few weeks than we normally would. But, So any final thoughts on all that insanity?
Well, you know, in talking about Rosas and where he came from in Houston, you know, something that's going to be really interesting to see how it shakes out is you look at Houston, who just traded Capella to Atlanta, and they have, you know, then they traded for Jordan Bell, so you're thinking, okay, maybe Jordan Bell is going to get some playing time finally. I actually kind of like Jordan Bell, energetic guy, hits the boards, blocks some shots. And they ship him to Memphis, and they came out and said that they are going to start PJ Tucker at center.
Yeah, they're going small.
PJ Tucker is 6'5".
Yeah.
Their center is going to be 6'5". I mean, if this thing works and they can actually win this, you're talking about a total overhaul potentially of the way, the fundamental way the NBA is played. You know, your big, huge center loafs up and down the court and has already started to go away. And if that thing takes off, it's not going to be a game for the players really anymore. You're going to have to be able to move and shoot. So.
Well, one of the reasons I thought they got rid of Capella is because they were like 18-2 when he was out of the lineup. So they must have figured that was something they could get away with. But yeah, I mean, with Cat in the lineup, that's not ever going to necessarily. I know Cat is more of a modern four or whatever, stretch four or five. But you know, I think it'd be fun to see the Timberwolves finally knock down some threes. They've been firing them up, but they've never been able to. They've been at the bottom of that for so long. Even after. you know, that movement's been happening for 5-10 years now, you know, to that. So, and they've never adjusted it. We've talked about the Twins a lot and how, you know, they've become kind of the darling of the analytical world over the last year. And they've made those, you know, those changes and those switches. The Wolves haven't yet. And so hopefully they can kind of get on board with some of these things that are taking place.
You know, they actually went backwards because of Thibodeau. You know, they brought Thibodeau in, and the way he wanted to play was slow it down and play big here and there. So they actually went backwards. In my football comparisons, it's actually like, you know, this year for the Timberwolves is basically like going from a triple option offense to an air raid.
Mm-hmm.
Only they were able to change this thing in about 24 hours. So the three-pointers are going to fly like we've never seen before. Hopefully they go down a little bit better, but at least they're going to look better.
Yeah. All right, let's wrap up that Wolves and we're come back. Our last talking point will be Pete Rose and his attempt to work his way into a possible Hall of Fame vote. Welcome back to Maybe Next Year. Our last talking point tonight is going to be we wouldn't really thought about talking about this, and then some news came out. Was it yesterday or 2 days ago? Where Pete Rose, who is an interesting talking point all himself, but he had actually sent a letter into Major League Baseball to the commissioner that asking it was a 19-page letter asking to be reinstated. And which he's done before. He did in 2015 and he asked the Hall of Fame in 2017 for admission in, but, or at least into the voting. But he did it now, at least according to his lawyers, because of everything that's taken place with the Astros and the fact that no players were, penalized or reprimanded for, their admitted, you know, science stealing. And, it was interesting reading some of the points that were made and not saying they were bad points, but saying that, okay, well, apparently serious violations no longer necessitate lifetime bans. So if we look back at him and he was banned in 1989. And you know, it was never proven. He lied for quite a while about never betting. He didn't admit it till 2004 that he actually bet. But you know, it's never proven that his betting influenced the outcome of any game or any player's performances. He said, you know, that he only bet on his team to win. Whether that's true or not, I guess we don't know, and so he can't really assume that. But his point is an interesting one about what necessitates a lifetime ban and what doesn't, and if these players aren't penalized for something as serious as that, does the punishment really fit the crime then for him? And I don't know, you know, and I'll let you kind of go first on what your thoughts on him. Yeah, I think the comparison up till this point was really, okay, well, we have these guys that we know for a fact with some of them and kind of in a roundabout way about others that took steroids and they're allowed into the Hall of Fame vote. I think it was kind of important to note that the Major League Baseball and the Hall of Fame are not connected. They're completely separate. They have different boards and things like that. It's just that the Hall of Fame tends to not want to upset Major League Baseball, so they go along. So if you've been got a lifetime ban by Major League Baseball, the Hall doesn't mess with that, and they go along with it basically. But when he was banned in 1989, you were still allowed to, it was not said that if you were banned from baseball, that you were not allowed into the Hall of Fame vote. And so there was no rule that said that. And so maybe that went into him signing off on the ban thinking, okay, well, you know, I can still get into the Hall of Fame. Well, it was 2 years later in 1991 that they then made the rule that if you had been banned by MLB, you were no longer eligible for the Hall of Fame vote. So that changed after that. And whether that, you know, has any effect on what he's trying to do now or whatever. But I guess you can give the stats all you want. The fact of the matter is his stats are incredible across the board. They're absolutely incredible. I mean, he leads Major League history with 4,256 hits, which is, it's hard to even wrap your mind around that many hits. You know, he played the most games in Major League history with over 3,500, and he has the most at-bats in Major League. He had 10 seasons of 200-plus hits. That's a big deal if you do it 1 year, you know, to do that 10 times. And he played 500 games at five different positions, first, second, third, left field, and right field. Those are mind-boggling, you know, facts. And so that's not a question whether his stats have earned him a spot in Cooperstown. But I guess when you were reading all this and kind of drudging up some of these questions that we've thought about or before or whatever, is he warranted? Do you think that this is something that really needs to be taken a serious look at?
You know, to me, Pete Rose has been one of the most polarizing figures in really baseball history. You read the articles, you see the stats, you know how long he lied, then he turned around and said, okay, I did it. You look at the fact that, like you said, he never bet against his team. He only bet on his team, which even as a coach, you know, you're not really influencing the game that much in my eyes, you know, unless there's you know, run totals or depending on how he bet, I suppose you possibly could, depending on some decisions late in games and stuff. But he never bet against his team, so he didn't throw any games. To me, I think it's warranted the way it is. This is the most leverage I think he's ever going to have to prove his case, to get himself back in. So I 100% agree with him trying to do it. You know, the guy played the game 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
You know, he's famous for running into the catcher. In one of the articles I read, you know, they talked about how he ran into the catcher.
The All-Star game.
Into the All-Star game. And in fact, in doing so, you know, he hurt himself and missed a couple of games. But he hit the catcher, and the catcher actually dislocated and tore up his shoulder. And it wasn't found out till like halfway through the next season that the guy had happened to him. And that guy went from being an All-Star to basically a normal catcher in the league.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy played 100 miles an hour all the time. It sounds like he basically lived life 100 miles an hour all the time. You look at some of the stuff he's done since he retired. He had a couple stints in the WWF where basically, yeah, I suppose he made some bucks to get body slammed through the ring. I'd like to at least see a conversation. I'd like to see him get his chance. Now, whether he deserves to get in the Hall of Fame, I don't know. To me, you look at the guys in the Hall of Fame, I guarantee you there are pitchers and hitters in the Hall of Fame who did steroids. They never got caught doing it, but I guarantee you there's got to be a guy in there who did it.
If you're talking about, I mean, if they're going to talk about, well, personality stuff, and he did some, there are some bad people that are in the Hall of Fame that did some really awful things in their life, you know, criminal stuff. And he looked at, you know, Hinch and Lunau, the coach and the GM for the Astros, they got 1 year bans for that, you know, 1 year ban. So I guess if I'm really, the roids thing is really kind of an interesting comparison, because Bonds, McGuire, Sosa, Clemens, they're not in the Hall, and they have, it looks like they probably aren't going to get in. They got 3 years left. I think all three of them have 3 years. McGuire's almost up. Bonds and Clemens have 3 years left. And then, you know, the Veterans Committee is not going to vote them in if they don't get in their initial one. But they're allowed that chance.
They're allowed, you know, that chance.
And Rose is not allowed that chance because of the ban. So I think if I'm going to make, I would like to just open him up to the voting. Just allow the voters to decide. Not let Major League Baseball pressure the Hall into not allowing that to happen. Now, the Hall doesn't like to go against Major League Baseball. You know, they work together in tandem, but I think if I could have it my way, I would just like to see, maybe he would never get in. Maybe it would go similar to a Bonds and a Clemens vote, where you'd have 50% of people that think he should be in and 50 that don't. That's not enough to get in. Got to have 75%, you know. So it would be really, really interesting. I think, you know, he's 78 years old. And maybe just being in the twilight or whatever, but maybe that's making him a little more desperate than he has been in the past. But I don't know. I think, like I said, there's some bad people in the Hall of Fame. You know, there's, like you said, there's people in there that took steroids. You know, they did. It's just that we weren't keeping an eye on it for 20 years like we are now. So his gambling did not create his stats. The gambling did not, you know, get him 4,200 hits. You know, it didn't. Where if you look at steroids, that might have contributed to the stats that got those people into the Hall of Fame. So, I'd like to see a chance. I'd like to see him get a chance to be voted. And then, you know what, if you don't get in, if the voters don't think you deserve it, then you know. You know, then you at least know that they don't believe you deserve it. So, I don't know. I guess if they were going to follow what you wanted, what would you do?
You took the words right out of my mouth. That's what I had written down in my notes. I'd like to see the ban come off and leave it up to the voters. And I even think he, not that I know Pete Rose, I've never even seen him in my life, but you look at a guy who he just wants the chance. The game meant so much to him. He just wants the ability to have the possibility of getting in. If he doesn't get in, I really think the guy could probably accept it. Okay, they didn't vote me yet. But to not know, you know, as hard as he played, and as much as baseball was like, to not even know if he could get in or given the chance, it eats at him. It's going to eat him forever. And the poor guy, if he doesn't get the chance where he passes, he'll probably spin circles in his grave for eternity. You know, it's
if you look at, okay,
I feel bad for the guy, he kind of dug his own grave. But when you compare it to the Astros situation,
that's what I was going to ask.
They actually cheated on the field, knowingly cheated on the field, affecting every game they played.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's much, much worse than Pete Rose, who gambled on his team to win. I mean, you can't, as a coach, you can't really, you're going to coach harder.
Yeah.
I mean, you change pitchers because you want to win. You know, he wanted to win every single game as a coach as it was. So he bet on his team to win. He didn't throw games. And that's kind of where the difference. He didn't change the game on the field in any manner that he wouldn't have done had he not been gambling. It's just the fact that he actually plays bets, which was against the rules.
And I know, we've talked, obviously, but we talked about the Astros and stuff like that. But I think in our conversations about it, I don't think, you know, probably baseball, more casual baseball fans and things like that, don't grasp how serious stealing signs using technology really is and how much it affects a game. And, you know, I know that they're not going to take away the Astros World Series title, but I think if there ever really was a legitimate, I think it's a legitimate conversation, you know, because I feel like, you know, if you look at, we talked a little bit about the guy that went through and watched the entire season and did the stats on, you know, how many times they banged on the garbage can and that kind of stuff. Man, you take some of that away and there's a lot of games they probably don't win. And, maybe they don't end up, maybe they end up in the playoffs, maybe they don't end up with home field, whatever. You know, it's incredible that we're just going to do away with that. And that's done. No players reprimanded. I know there's issues, there's problems with reprimanding players because a lot of them aren't still with the Astros or whatever. But I that's why I think when I read his letter or his lawyer's letter to Rob Manfred that I saw some legitimacy in it. You know, I really did. And really the biggest thing is what necessitates a lifetime ban. That wordage kind of stuck with me a little bit. What he did, how can you compare that? You know, is it really comparable, or is it just because of when it took place, you know, in the late 80s or whatever? But yeah, I don't know. And it is sad that this whole sign stealing thing is going to be forgotten pretty quickly, at least by the average fan, you know, and everybody moves on with their lives. Well, Hinch doesn't, but a couple other coaches don't move on with their lives, but all those players are going to move on, and they all benefited from it. And even one of the current Twins benefited from it with Marwin Gonzalez, you know, and they proved that with some of the stats too, how he benefited from that. And how they all did hitting at home. So, yeah, I guess I guess we kind of feel the same way that maybe just give him a shot, you know.
Give him a shot.
And you don't have to allow him back into the dugouts, and you don't have to let him, you know, be part of either the Reds organization or whatever. You know, you don't have to allow that, but you can allow him the ability for the Hall of Fame voters to decide, as opposed to Major League Baseball's commissioner deciding for him what's going to happen. But, you know, I did read some other articles like I was telling you, but I think that probably the consensus that this isn't going to happen, and that it's probably just kind of another last ditch effort. So I guess we'll find out, but there hasn't been any response yet from Major League Baseball yet, and I don't know if there will be. But any final thoughts on Rose?
Yeah, you know, just kind of going, you know, thinking yesterday, going back on the level that he cheated or broke the rules and the Hall of Fame and the steroids. And, you know, you see it in the major league. You look at Michael Pineda, he got popped 50 games for performance-enhancing drug. You know, that's taking a substance to improve your play that's illegal. So how is that really any different than necessarily gambling? Now, he didn't get caught till basically he was done. But if a player today is caught betting on his own game, is he going to get an immediate lifetime ban, or is he going to get a 50-game suspension? Or, you know, what type of – if it happened today to a player, you know, how are they going to handle that in comparison to how they've treated him? It's something that kind of crossed my mind.
Yeah, I guess does the punishment fit the crime? And I don't believe it does.
Yep.
I don't. Yep. And maybe, you know, we weren't baseball fans in the late 80s or anything like that, but – you know, maybe it would have affected us different if we were growing up watching him or anything like that. But yeah. So yeah, I guess that's open to, I hope there is a conversation. I think you said that it would be nice to at least hear, you know, whether Manfred will say anything or whatever. It'd be nice to hear what their take is on it. Okay. If you really want to compare it to what the Astros did, I'd like to hear why you think no player should be reprimanded and why there should only be 1 year ban as opposed to a lifetime ban for Rose. I want that explanation, at least why it's looked at differently by Major League Baseball.
And I think he's owed that explanation too after all this time.
Right. All right. So we'll wrap that one up and we'll come on back for our final predictions of the week.
Away from yours.
Welcome back to Maybe Next Year, episode 11. We're going to finish up tonight by making our bold predictions for the week. It hasn't been an easy one to try and come up with something here. There's with all the things that have been going on. But Dave, you got a Timberwolves one? I do too. What do you got?
Yeah, I'm going to go Timberwolves, and they are going to shoot 55 three-pointers in the first game that they get Russell.
55.
First game to get everybody back. I think their tempo is going to be up high enough. They're literally going to start shooting 50, 55 three-pointers a night.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to watch. My bold prediction is they play the Clippers on Saturday. And I think, well, obviously you're going to have a good number of those new bodies in there because they don't have enough people to put on the court. But if you get Russell and you get some of those new bodies out there, I think it's going to get weird on Saturday against the Clippers at home. And I think they're going to pull off just a really odd win. The Clippers have been moving some pieces too, but I think you're going to have a lot of fans turn out that night at Target Center that are just curious to see what in the world is going on there. So if everybody, I think if most of their major pieces that they've traded for are playing on Saturday night, they get a weird one. That's what I'm going to go with. So, all right. That's what we got for the night. Thanks a lot for listening. Make sure that you check us out on Apple Podcasts, Anchor, or Spotify. And check out our website as well at nextyearpodcast.com. A lot of things there for you to see. And be sure to send us your questions. If you're looking to hopefully build a website, check out our sponsor, MinnesotaNiceMarketing.com as well. Dave, thanks a lot for coming on and chatting with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Fun as always.
All right. We'll see you next time.